Hey, folks, this is a special supplemental edition of the MGO podcast where we interview all four Republican and Democratic candidates for Regent. Now, I don't feel like the Regency Board of the University of Michigan is a particularly partisan position. I feel like you should evaluate each of these people by the things that they say and the things that they've done and not necessarily the party by their names. And while I have you, if you are an Ann Arbor resident, please vote against Proposal A. If you don't live in Ann Arbor, you can safely skip the next 2 minutes of this podcast. So Proposal A would set aside the library lot for a Civic Center Commons. And the library lot currently has an underground parking deck on it. So of all the places in the city to put a downtown park, it makes the least sense. It has been specifically reinforced to put a big building on it. The city council has agreed to sell that for $10 million to a company called Core Spaces that will build a 17-story building with 360 apartments, a bunch of hotel, retail, and office space. It's a good spot for it. The library board has made the decision to come out against this publicly, which is very rare for them. Chela's, the restaurant across the street, is opposed to Prop A. The Parks Commission in Ann Arbor is opposed to Prop A because they don't feel like it's a good spot for a park. It's really about not having the development in a city that really needs housing. So please vote against it. And if you do, come up to me and say, I voted against Prop A, and I'll give you a high five. Now on to the Regents. With Democratic Regent candidate Paul Brown, who is a professor at the university, member of the Leo Union, and you teach in the engineering school.
I do. I teach a finance and business course in the Center for Entrepreneurship in the engineering school. One course, been doing it for many years. I'm also a partner in a venture capital fund here in Ann Arbor.
So how did you get involved with a Regents race?
Well, it's something I got my undergrad in history here and my MBA, and my family's been involved in the University of Michigan for a long time, although I grew up in a small town in northern Michigan. Spent a lot of football Saturdays down here and was very intimately aware of the Regents and what they do. And as I kind of considered where to do public service, I thought this was the spot that I would be most passionate about, and felt needed the most help, and thought that my skill set and experience could lend to the board.
So one of the most pressing issues facing any university right now is affordability.
Absolutely.
And Michigan's made some efforts to publicize the fact that if you don't make a ton of money,
yep,
you're not going to have to,
yep,
pay tuition here.
Yeah.
Is that sufficient in your mind? What more can Michigan do to increase the affordability?
It's not sufficient. And I think the affordability of higher education may be the issue of our time in our society. There was a time where you could work about 300 hours of a minimum wage job and pay for a year of school. And that's gone up into about 1,500 hours, which, of course, you can't do,
right,
in a summer or even while you're going to school. You referenced the Go Blue
guarantee,
which any family in Michigan who has a household income of $65,000 or less can go here tuition-free, so to speak, scholarships, et cetera.
Right.
I applaud the effort. It's not enough. Number one, tuition is less than half of the actual cost of going to school, and whether the remainder, room and board, that is, was a dollar or $1 billion, it might as well be $1 billion, yeah, because some of those families just can't afford it.
If anything, should the university be doing to help affordability in terms of,
yep,
room and board? Because Ann Arbor is a very expensive city.
It is a very expensive
and
city.
Like, how,
yeah,
do they?
Yeah, there are a few very specific things they can be doing and should be doing already, and I will advocate for if I'm lucky enough to be on the board. Number one, the university just completed a $5 billion endowment fundraise that puts our endowment almost to $12 billion. Several years ago, even when my opponents were on the board, they cut the draw, the amount of money they take off the endowment over the last couple of decades, by over a point. That represents tens of millions of dollars per year if they just increased back to their 1980 and 90 level, that could be going back into student scholarships and to pay down the need for tuition, number one. Number two, the University of Michigan has run a budget surplus of several hundred million dollars, averaging over the last 10 years over $300 million per year. Two things could be done with that. Number one, better budgeting. I understand you have to be conservative because you don't want to be in the red at the end of the year. But the last couple of years has been closer to $500 million. As I say, that $300 million average over 10, that is I would say not good budgeting.
Out of what's the total?
A little over a $10 billion budget. So percentage-wise,
that's pretty big.
Yeah, it's still a big number. But we have to maintain our AAA credit rating. We have to keep our rainy day fund funded. That said, that number should be more accurately forecast to diminish the need to bring in revenue through tuition, number one. And number two, something that I've never heard a university do, and which I think we should consider, is when we do run a huge surplus like that, rebate it back to the students that paid more tuition than we needed to bring in. And it could be done in a conservative way. You could do it on a five-year running average, which is the way the university budgets. You could do it, of course, after you fund a rainy day fund, and as long as you keep your AAA rating. I think that's what we should be doing. It's the students' money and their families, and we should
get these are all tuition mitigation strategies.
Correct.
Is there anything that Michigan should be doing to
cost?
Well, to change the nature of the city around it so that it's less expensive to live in.
Yeah. So, number one, when you look at the cost of tuition has increased over 3x since my opponents have been on the board. And they absolutely have the best interest of the students in Michigan in mind. They just haven't been able to achieve the goals.
Well, that's a sticker price, right? So, not... The average student paying who's makes an average amount of money isn't seeing that sticker price increase.
Well, it depends on the student, of course.
Yeah.
If you're that $65,000 or less income, that's better. But I look at it as if you have a family of a nurse and a police officer, you shouldn't have to pay for school for your kids to go here. But, of course, room and board is a big part of it, which you mentioned. I think that's the question you're asking. There are a couple things we can do. North Campus was built here a few years ago, and that was the first dorm that was built on the Michigan campus, I think.
North Quad, excuse me.
And I think three decades, even though the school had been growing almost every year. Student housing is cheaper than the private sector housing here, and I think even better quality, safer housing. And we should look to build more housing. We can do it cheaper, we can do it better, and offer it as a product to our students cheaper than the private sector can, number one. Number two, there are some areas like Stanford and NYU that live in such high real estate cost areas that they will subsidize housing even for faculty and staff.
Right.
And when a nurse has to live an hour and a half away just to afford their housing and commute in, that doesn't work. That's an exploitative model, and we have to look at some of those mitigating actions.
Okay. The Obama administration issued the Dear Colleague letter that radically reshaped the way that universities handle sexual assault cases.
Yep.
The new Secretary of Education revised that in two major ways, which is one, going from a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is basically 51%, to a clear and convincing standard, and ensuring that the accused has an opportunity to cross-examine.
Yep.
Are those good changes? Are those bad changes? And how should a university deal with these things going forward?
I think those are bad changes. I think the original Obama administration standards were good. There were obviously issues about the right to defend oneself, but this is not a court of law. This is not a criminal case. And there were ways that you could have given that accused the right to challenge and present evidence without kind of re-victimizing the victim.
Okay.
Whether it be answering questions in front of the
seems like
perpetrator.
Many universities have struggled to get that right.
Yep.
Including the University of Michigan.
I think it's a really hard thing to get right.
Okay.
And I think we'll continue to struggle for a long time. You have to think about your own workplace, whether you're a boss or an employee. If you had one of these issues happen in your workplace where someone accused the other of rape or sexual assault, how would you handle it? And when you if you consider the criminal standard, I don't think there's any business in the world that would hold up that standard as the one that should be followed.
Well, criminal standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, and yep. that is not clear and convincing.
So right. Clear and convincing is a tort right. standard, and I still think in order to protect the victims and the educational environment for everyone on campus, I think something less than clear and convincing or preponderance.
What does the university need to do to prevent a recurrence of the Drew Sterrett incident where he was expelled from campus and then successfully sued the university for violating his due process rights?
Yep. I'm not familiar enough with the case to comment on it. I'm a lawyer, and that's why I'm probably overly cautious. I think you do need a process that's prescriptive, that everyone knows their rights, and the students, when they come into campus, understand those rights and agree to follow them. And I think that is where this case fell down, that the accused did not understand and could not have understood what his rights were going to be, and that's as much as I can comment on the details of that.
So the Free Press recently came out with a series of articles detailing some self-dealing, some things that look like improprieties dealing with Michigan's endowment. How much of a concern is that for you, and what kind of changes would you want to make if you were a regent?
Yeah, it's a huge concern. Not so much that I think the regents that were accused of, so to speak, the self-dealings, did it in any way at all. They absolutely, I believe, have, and I know, have the best interest of the school at heart. But it was the appearance of impropriety. And as a public institution, we need to even avoid that. And so my running mate, Jordan Acker, and I put out a 10-point ethics and transparency plan that tackled some of these issues. Setting the table, the University of Michigan invests its endowments in some of the greatest venture and private equity funds, et cetera, in the world, some of which are run by University of Michigan alums. They're some of the best funds in the world. But you can, as you say, when those fund managers who are receiving tens of millions of dollars from the University of Michigan donate to a regent member who approves those investments, that looks like self-dealing, and we can't allow it. And so our 10-point plan had a couple of specific things. Number one, you cannot take any campaign donations from managers who have University of Michigan money. If you do, or if you already have before it comes before the board, you have to recuse yourself from the vote reveal that donation. And then number three, we should have or consider a total prohibition against making University of Michigan investments in those alums, or at the very least, have a third-party, non-university-related review committee review those investments.
Okay. How much should a full-time adjunct lecturer make annually?
Well, they should make the same in Flint, Dearborn, and Ann Arbor, and they should make a living wage. I am one of these, although I don't get my primary source of income from it. I am very sympathetic to these amazing, dedicated professors, most of which this is their full-time job, and when you have master's and graduate degrees, you're publishing, I think we should, except for the rarest occurrence, eliminate the lecturer position and squish them all into tenured or teaching professor track and
okay.
pay them virtually the same.
All right.
Every one of our kids deserves the best education and the best teachers they can get.
Okay.
They deserve to be treated the same, those
and
teachers.
My wife is an adjunct, so this is something that it doesn't affect us financially all that much because I have the fortunate position I am in.
The greatest blog in the world.
But, from my perspective, if my wife was married to someone who had her same job, it would be impossible for her to have children.
Yeah, I don't know if your viewers know that Flint and Dearborn are paid less. The professors or the lecturers, so to speak, are paid less than those at Ann Arbor. And for a starting lecturer position, it's in the 30,000s, high 30s. In Ann Arbor, it's in the low 40s. And you just can't live off that, and especially considering the education and talent of these lecturers, it's astounding to me that the market has allowed this to happen.
If there was one thing that you could just unilaterally do to the university, you're God on the mountain.
Wow.
You have no money. You have no extra money.
Okay.
You have the same amount of money you have now.
Yes.
But like, what is the one thing that you would change?
If I only had one wish, so to speak, of what we could do at the University of Michigan, it would be for the citizens of Michigan to recommit to supporting higher education and K through 12 at that, in terms of going back to the era of the 60s and 70s, when approximately 70% of the cost of tuition was covered by the state, that is for in-state students.
Okay. Well, you can't have any more money.
I didn't spend university money. All right. Another one is there was always an unwritten rule that the University of Michigan would not admit more than one-third of its students from out of state.
Okay.
That's now gone to over 50%. Taxpayers of Michigan have paid for this university for its 200-year history. It was created to educate the students of our state. We need to go back to at least two-thirds of the students coming from in-state.
That is aggressive.
Yeah.
All right. Michigan's FOIA office has been kind of recalcitrant for a long period of time.
They
take the maximum amount of time under law. Under Dave Brandon, there was an athletic department policy where they would periodically delete emails to remove them from FOIA.
Yep.
As a regent, would you make changes to the office, and what would you do?
I think the University of Michigan needs to follow the same FOIA requirements as state government.
Okay.
And so scrubbing all of those communications is illegal in state government and should be at the University of Michigan as well. Our 10-point transparency plan and ethics plan attacked some of this. A few more things that we should do is move all meetings to the evening so students and community members can attend more easily. We should live stream all of them, and we should make our decisions in public, in meetings. For those of you that are familiar with the way the University of Regents seems to work, is
they get a lot of 8-0 votes.
You get a lot of 8-0 votes with very little discussion, which just tells you that they are having those debates behind closed doors, out of earshot of the public who pays for this institution and elects the board.
All right. Anything else that you had that you want to get to?
Gosh, I think that Flint and Dearborn are two of the obviously three campuses of the University of Michigan. I think they are often overlooked by the board. I want to be that board member that represents those two schools and those two communities, number one. And I want to make it easier for students to decide to attend those two universities and transfer in and out of University of Michigan Ann Arbor. It would save them money. It would increase enrollment at those two institutions, which we desperately need. So it would solve, you know,
might
two
help
problems with one shot.
Michigan's diversity issues.
It would greatly affect their diversity issues, as another unfortunate stat over the last several years is that the percentage of African American students at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor has gone down by over half, and it wasn't very good to begin with. The other is if I'm the only one in this race, and I would be the only one on the Board of Regents who is from anywhere outside of a 60-mile radius of the Detroit suburbs.
Okay.
And the west side of the state, or northern Michigan where I come from, our kids matter. We've been paying taxes for this university for its whole existence. And again, I'd in many ways like to be the representative of the students and the citizens from those geographical areas.
One final thing before we do let you go. I mean, in the context of what happened with Larry Nassar, obviously transparency is extraordinarily important for these regent races in particular, and hopefully those over the next 10 years.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to know how you're approaching that.
Well, that is actually the most common question I get around the state during the campaign. And I lay the blame of that on the feet of the board and the president. Their statement that they didn't know it was this bad, they didn't know it had gone on that long, is an indictment of their own job or lack thereof. I've sat on a lot of boards, small and large, public and private, and you have many roles. Two of the most important are, number one, you identify those things in your institution, whether it's a college or a car dealership, that can kill your entity. And when you have an athletic program, a medical facility, and students, sexual assault is one of those things that you have to create policies and procedures for to make sure it never happens. And if it does happen, it's elevated to the board level and tracked almost daily to make sure it doesn't happen again, number one. And then number two, you have to create a culture that cares more about the students than the administrators, cares more about the athletes than the coaches, and cares more about the patients than the doctors. They failed to do that, and I want to make sure that never happens here at University of Michigan.
All right, Paul Brown, he is running as a Democrat. It's not a straight ballot, so you have to go vote for him on purpose.
That's right.
So he's way down the ballot, and he's giving you his point of view.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is great.
So we're here with Democratic Regent candidate Jordan Acker. You can say hi now.
Hi, Brian.
Visual podcast.
Oh, yes. Extremely visual.
And unlike most Regent candidates, we have a history.
Yeah.
I feel badly about this, but back in the ancient days of blogging, like 2004, 2005, probably.
Yeah, I was definitely an undergrad here at U of M when that happened.
You don't think anyone's reading you, and you're 25, so you're very fired up about things. You can get a little bit over the top. And you wrote an article that I completely bombed on MGO Blog.
Yeah, I'm glad that we're starting the podcast off on this note.
I feel badly about this.
Because when you're done telling your side of the story, I'd like to share a little bit of...
But you've recovered from this to become a pillar of the community.
Well, look, like you, Brian, I was a kid at that point. Yeah. I mean, I was literally a sophomore or junior at U of M.
I remember you had one sentence with seven commas in it.
I stopped doing that, thankfully. We had to...
I mean, you're a lawyer, right? So that's kind of like par for the course sometimes.
It is. You know, you convinced me that law school was the proper path for me.
This is not making me feel better.
I'm eminently grateful for that to this day, Brian. I want to add a little part of the story because this is something that I don't know if we've ever discussed, but has come up. So after a long time after this, I was working in Washington, and I'll, you know, get into my story in a few minutes, but I was working in Washington, and in my office at the Department of Homeland Security, were four or five of us. We all had Michigan ties, or we were alums of the university.
Sure.
And you were in Washington to give a pre-football season speech.
Yeah.
And they invited me. They know I'm a huge Michigan fan. They invite me to come along, and they said, you know, Brian Cook's going to be speaking. And I said, you know, I don't think it's a great idea for me to go.
Really?
And they said, why? You? I know you read MGO Blog all the time. I was like, yeah, I don't think it's a great idea. And one of them Googled my name and your name.
Oh,
and at that point, it was printed out and shared amongst those of us who went to the university. And now at that point, they said, not only should you go, you must go. So we went to this. And we walk in, and it's a bunch of us, you know, we're coming direct from work, we're wearing suits, and you see me, and I introduce myself to you, and the look on your face, I don't know what you thought I was going to do.
I was worried for my personal well-being.
But the first thing you said to me, and I'll never forget this, was well, it looks like you did okay for yourself after that article.
And you did. So
I am with that said, it was what, 15 years ago now?
Yeah.
You know, I never stopped reading, and I love what you guys do here. I appreciate you being a little nicer to me if I'm elected, especially. Well,
I try not to burn undergrads anymore. So
well, that's a good rule.
That is a good rule.
I think that that's a good thing to live by, but you know, in any way, it's great to be sitting down with you. This is a dream for me to be on your podcast and not repeat hopefully those days of
we're past that. We're both past it. So why don't we talk about you're running for regent.
Yes.
You got past our previous issue, and then you became a member of the Obama administration.
Right. So
why don't you give us your background?
Yeah, so after I left U of M in 2006, I went to work in politics for a little bit. I went to work on the for the House Judiciary Committee in Washington. And I felt that the best way to move forward in my, what I really wanted was a career in national security policy. And so I decided the best way to do that was to go to law school. And of course, I entered, I went to American University for law school. And I, of course, had the great timing of starting law school in August of 2007. And of course, Lehman Brothers happened about 3 weeks later, which is, of course, wonderful timing. I decided to continue to pursue that background. In 2010, after I graduated, like most people of you know, my generation of the going to school at that time, there were no jobs. And I got incredibly lucky. A friend of mine that I had volunteered with on the Obama administration, in the Obama campaign, excuse me, here in Michigan, was working in the White House in the Office of Presidential Personnel. Ended up working in the Office of Presidential Personnel and then moving over to the Department of Homeland Security, where I advised the deputy first the secretary and then the deputy secretary, and did her daily briefings for about 2.5 years, which was pretty exciting, pretty amazing stuff that goes on. And you know, the Department of Homeland Security is a huge...
Did you know the Osama bin Laden thing was going down before everybody else did?
So actually,
can you not tell me that?
I don't want to talk about okay. specifics there, other than at about 2:30 in the morning, my BlackBerry would not stop ringing,
right.
And we at that point we had been given the heads up that this had happened, but
sure.
It was still one of those surreal experiences, to say the least.
Sure,
it that was actually bookended by my last week at Homeland Security, which was the week of the Boston bombing,
right.
And we were supporting some of the law enforcement agencies. And my job was obviously to keep the deputy secretary informed as to what was going on and what some of these law enforcement agencies were able to pull up in 24 to 48 hours. You're talking about stacks of eighth grade essays from these particular bombers. It's pretty amazing what our law enforcement was able to do. But honestly, after a few years in living in Washington and paying, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars in rent for a tiny apartment in a not that great neighborhood, my wife and I said, what are we doing here? Ultimately, do we want to raise a family here? Is this a place that we can live? And my wife is a university graduate also. She's from Chicago originally. We decided that we wanted to be a little bit closer to home. Ended up moving 5 blocks away from my parents, ironically, of all places.
That is close to home.
Yeah, you know, before we had kids, it was kind of a, ooh, this is a little too close. Now it's the greatest
sure.
thing
yeah,
ever.
That's definitely.
You know, how I got to this path of running for region is a pretty, it's a pretty roundabout one. You know, most of the people who run for these positions, as I'm sure you know, are the insider choice. They're, you know, years and years of party affiliation or, you know, something specific like that. And that's not what happened with me. I decided to run for region ultimately because of something horrible that happened to me in 2016. I suffered a crazy, crazy illness. I was playing basketball on a Saturday morning, and I went to the doctor that Monday, and the doctor said, oh, you just got some back spasms. I guess this is what happens now when you get in your 30s. Things just start hurting.
People, you go to the doctor, and you're like, yep, that happens.
Yeah, they're like, you know, you're playing competitive sports, and you're over 30 years old now. I went to the doctor, and the doctor prescribed me Flexerol. I took one Flexerol. My liver shut down. I lost 40 pounds in about 6 weeks. I was in pretty rough shape and ended up here at the University of Michigan Hospital. And I saw one of the specialists in this particular field, someone who had been doing research for years and years and years on these sorts of liver ailments. And he saved my life. And I feel unbelievably grateful for that. And, you know, I felt like I needed to give back to the university. And finally, I think the biggest thing was about perspectives on these boards. You know, I talk about before about how you get on there.
Yeah.
We don't have anybody on the board today who graduated from college in this century. We don't have anybody on the board today who's paid student loan bills. Now, I was incredibly lucky to be able to be on the MET program and graduate from undergrad debt-free. That was not the case in law school.
Sure.
I finished law school with over $110,000 worth of student debt. It's terrifying. It's terrifying. And I hear from parents and students all throughout the state, where they go to Michigan, where they're going somewhere else, that the student debt crisis has gotten so out of control. And the proof is in the pudding here.
Okay, so this is transitioning more into the policy
sure.
section of our discussion.
I know, I'm kind of a dork for this stuff.
No, you know? let's talk about this. So
yeah.
Michigan's in one of these situations where their support from the state isn't what it used to be on a per capita basis.
Nope.
They have differential pricing so that they charge more wealthy people more money to help balance it out. They have the Go Blue guarantee, where anyone making the median of about $62,000 in the state is guaranteed free tuition if mm-hmm. they get in.
Yep.
Has the university done enough in that regard to bring costs down, and what more should they do?
It's a great question. So I think that the answer is the university was doing better than some other schools, but the university has the capacity and the ability to do so much more.
And what would that look like?
So I think Michigan has two problems when it comes to this. The first one is a PR problem. So I'll tell you, one of the things about running for regent when you travel around the state is you hear what people's actual perspectives are about the University of Michigan. When I was up in Escanaba in February, and by the way, going to Escanaba in February, it is extremely cold. Beautiful, beautiful town, but wow, is it cold then. But you hear from people that they don't even think that the University of Michigan is for them because of the cost.
Yeah.
And I think part of the issue is that we talk about tuition as if it's the baseline cost, but I think it's not. I think the cost of attendance is the one that we need to be looking at first and foremost.
Okay, so this is actually another thing on my list. So Ann Arbor is a very expensive city, getting more expensive. What yeah. should the University of Michigan do to help students out in that regard?
So the university is the largest landowner in Washtenaw County and in the city of Ann Arbor. I think that the university needs to look pretty seriously at maximizing its spaces on this campus when it comes to housing. You know, we actually just held a forum with students about this a few days ago, talking about how there has been tremendous growth on this campus in terms of buildings. Incredible growth. And yet, we really only have one brand new dorm over the last 40 years. Yes, there's been some major renovations. There's major renovations on the hill at Cousins, but ultimately we need to be maximizing
there's
our
two.
Space.
There's the Munger dorm that just went up.
Oh, that's right. You're talking about two, though,
two, yeah.
in 40-plus years. Yeah. And I think that's a really big problem. I think we need to make sure that we maximize our space on North Campus. On the other place that I would look at is actually down Getty's, where we have all those apartment-style houses down there. We're not maximizing our space. And so I think that the other side of it, too, and one of the parts that goes into this is we need to have a better relationship with the local government and the city of Ann Arbor.
Okay.
I think that's a big part of this problem.
So when Michigan builds a dorm, no tax revenue goes to the actual city.
Right.
And that's kind of an issue between the city and the university. And
it's one that we get asked about all the time right. from city administrators, from the city council, from county commissioners, because
what can the University of Michigan do to like help kind of bridge this gap where, yes, we get the tax revenue from this, but we also have an element where we have housing for people who might be making less than $62,000 a year as a household and probably need some sort of subsidized place to live.
Right. And so I think that the reality is that the university has to work with the city to build more of this housing. And, you know, like we just talked about off before we came back on, this is something that the city officials know a lot more about it than we do.
Yeah.
And that certainly I do as a region candidate. And it's something that I expect to learn more on as if I'm elected next week. But ultimately, I think that for the university, I think maximizing our spaces is one of the most important things. We saw this, and we were talking about my experience in Washington. Washington has an incredible problem with this because they don't maximize their space, and it's pushed basically all affordable housing almost out of the city entirely. Yeah. We've seen something like that actually happen here in Ann Arbor, and now we're actually seeing that in the eastern part of the county, where it's where it was more affordable, is becoming more and more expensive as well. So I think that when we talk about building on campus, I think the building has to include affordable housing, and I think the university has to build public more public spaces for people to live, whether it's undergrads or whether it's families, whether it's for staff housing, whether it's for lecturers or for people who work at the university, to have affordable housing to live in Ann Arbor. And I think, as I'm sure you know, being a Ann Arbor resident, Ann Arbor has become so unaffordable. My wife and I, when we were looking at moving back to Michigan, this was actually the first place we looked.
Luck.
And we crunched the numbers and said this was actually more expensive than living in D.C. For us, it was just unaffordable, and I know that for a lot of university employees, it's the same way.
So for, and that contributes to computing, it also makes the Gobu guarantee a little bit hollow, because you still have to find a place to live.
Right. So it's a Gobu guarantee is a good start.
Yeah.
But as we all know, for the most part, the Gobu guarantee is a part of essentially a PR package, right?
I mean,
for the most part,
that was already true.
It was already true, and I'm glad that more people know about it. But it can't just be an advertisement or a story in a newspaper. And I talked about Escanaba before, because I got some amazing feedback up there. But one of the things that I got from up there was that the university doesn't recruit from the Upper Peninsula in the way that it used to, that they're not going there and saying University of Michigan is for you, and here's how you afford to go here. They've cut staffing that actually live up there and recruit in local high schools. And it was one of the biggest complaints that I received, not just in Escanaba, but throughout most of the state, was the university just isn't recruiting their students to come here anymore.
Sure.
And part of it is a cost issue, but part is they don't know the particular programs that would make it cost effective. One of the great meetings that I had over the past year was with the two incredible young women who founded the How to Be Not Rich at Michigan Guide, which I'm sure you've seen.
Yes, I have.
To me, that was one of the saddest days I've had as an alum of this place, because I think that the norm at this university shouldn't be the rich.
So
I think it should be middle-class Michiganders.
When the GoBlu guarantee was announced, there were people talking about it and its impact. And 16% of the undergrad population at Michigan qualifies, which means that 16% of the undergrad population at Michigan is beneath the median in terms of income. So, I think that,
and that's right, and it's something I've heard, by the way, a lot from teachers, actually, as I've traveled across the state, is they say, well, me and my husband are both school teachers, we do okay, but we have three kids, we're not wealthy, but we're just above that $65,000. Michigan's out of touch for
us. So they've started talking about, like, so if you're at $65,000, you're not paying full freight, right? Like, it's a very gradual thing.
Correct.
They haven't made that particularly clear.
I think that's a big part of the PR problem when it comes to the GoBlu guarantee is, like I said before, we know that nobody's paying full freight up to the $63,000,
right,
whatever it is. But ultimately, if people don't know about it, if people aren't aware of what they're actually paying, and if it doesn't cover the full cost of living here and going here, it's ultimately something that, for example, you'll hear from families, and I've heard from families that say, well, Michigan's package is not competitive compared to an out-of-state school like a Princeton for engineering, when that kid is from Michigan.
Right.
When I hear those kinds of stories, as I've heard, that is really, really depressing to me.
Okay. I think we have your general perspective on this. We need to, like, hit some other areas.
Yeah, let's talk about other stuff.
Okay. During the Obama administration, the Department of Education released the Dear Colleague letter that radically changed the way sexual assault was adjudicated on campus.
Yes.
The new Secretary of Education has released different guidelines that change two important things. One, they changed the standard of evidence from a preponderance, which is basically 51%, to a clear and convincing standard.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing they do is that they want to guarantee an opportunity for someone to cross-examine during these, I don't know what you would call them.
The hearings. They're the on campus yeah. hearings, right.
So, you know, are those good changes? Would you roll those back if you had the power to do so? Like, what is the role of the university in adjudicating sexual assault complaints?
These are really, really tough situations to handle. I think that that's the first thing, that there's no easy solution here. So I want to just talk about each one of these separately, because I think that they're important. You know, I tend to agree with, I was actually listening to Regent Deitch's interview with you a couple years ago about this, and I tend to agree with him on the standard that's needed here. I think that there is two big parts that are something that we need to address. And the first one is we need to do a better job at listening to victims. One of the things that I've tried to do throughout the course of this campaign is talking to victims' rights groups about what they think, making sure that women who are sexually assaulted, if we're talking about campus, the vast majority are women, that they're not being put through a second trauma. I think that's something that's really, really important. Yeah. I think the other principle, and this is something that the university fought all the way to the Court of Appeals a couple weeks ago and actually lost, but I think the university was right on, is that we need to make sure that when we have these sorts of situations, that we don't see the disparity by income. And what I mean by that is that what we've seen when we have allowed these sorts of hearings on campus is that people of color and people from lower incomes are far more likely to be kicked out of school and far more likely to not have counsel, all of these other things. So I think we have to be really careful in these sorts of things. I talked to some of my friends, actually worked on the original Dear Colleague letter at the Department of Education, and they've said to me that it didn't allow enough space for the university to create their own policies. It didn't allow that maybe it went a little too far, not in that it attacks sexual assault victims,
right,
but that it didn't allow universities the room that they needed to create policies that were right for them.
Well, and you're seeing kind of a wave of lawsuits from people who have been expelled mm-hmm. from universities and feel that they were not given due process.
Right.
And Michigan was on the losing end of one of those lawsuits.
Correct.
So how much should a full-time adjunct professor make after 5 years of experience?
That is a great, great question. So I'm going to answer it this way.
No. I want a number.
I
want a number.
Brian, I went to law school. I don't work in numbers.
No, you got to give me a number.
Well, let me... I want to say this about this, because...
I want a number.
I'll give you a number.
Okay.
I want to say about this, and I know that we're talking about this just for those who are listening who don't know. We're just coming through a period where there was a huge labor negotiation with the lecturers.
Yes.
We're about a year away, I think, a year and change away from having a graduate student instructors,
right,
the contract end. And we're going to be back in negotiations. We've, of course, just had this happen with the nurses a couple weeks ago. I think that the university must, and this is not just an Ann Arbor thing, it is far worse at Dearborn and especially at Flint, pay a fair and living wage in each of these communities. And yes, while I understand that the cost of living is different in Ann Arbor and in Dearborn and Flint, ultimately, I hear this feedback all the time at all three campuses that they're not being paid a fair wage. When it comes to the Regents, I know you're looking at me like you want a number.
I want a number. What feels like a fair compensation for a full-time adjunct professor at the University of Michigan?
I think that it depends on the campus, but I think that we have to, as a regent, I think it's important that we live by these principles of paying a fair wage. I was frankly disappointed in how long this process took, and I was frankly disappointed in how long it took for the regents to get involved in the process.
All right. We have just excised a very long conversation where I try to press him for a number, and you have good reasons not to do that, because it commits you as a hypothetical regent to numbers that the university, it's not your job to do.
Right. That's ultimately right.
So my point here is that the the adjuncts just went through a contract process.
Yes.
And this took 6 months, and they authorized a strike that they didn't actually have to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a huge raise.
They did.
And I think any number that you would have given me would have been at least the median income of the state of Michigan, which is $62,000.
Sure.
And they are still far short of that.
And I think that a big part of this is, by the way, is the university has, in my view, the wrong perspective as to what lecturers are and what lecturers do. That for a lot of these households, and I sat down with the lecturers, I signed up for a shift for a strike because I think this is so important, that for a lot of these households, they are the primary income in the household.
Right.
And we need to make sure that they are able to afford to live here. I've heard far too many stories from lecturers who are commuting from Canton to be able to live to teach in Ann Arbor. I don't think it's appropriate. I think they should be able to afford to live in Washtenaw County.
All right. I was going to ask you some other questions along those lines, but... We're going. I think that's enough of a commitment that we can move on. So
thank you, Brian.
All right. Two things about transparency. So the Free Press just had a fairly extensive recent series of articles about the Michigan's endowment. There's some self-dealing going in there. What, if anything, do you think needs to be changed with Michigan's relationship to the people who manage the endowment?
So I want to say this real quickly about that particular story. For those of you who don't know, one of my Republican opponents was accused of some self-dealing when it came to the endowment. I want to say on that particular issue that I don't think that's a fair attack. I think that Regent Newman specifically acts in what she believes is the best interest of the university as a regent. And I think that to suggest that a $2,000 donation suddenly swayed her on $100,000 is quite frankly, it's absurd. With that said, there's a lot of things that the university needs to do a better job when it comes to transparency with the endowment. Now, the people in charge today say, well, you can't do that. You can't because it's a competitive advantage. And there's some truth to some of that. However, my Democratic colleague and I who are running for this, we put out a 10-point plan on transparency and ethics. And two of them, number four and number five, were about the particular issues when it comes to the endowment. I think less region involvement is better for this reason only. The reason why is because regents, they right now are taking political donations. They take political donations from people who invest in the endowment. The university takes money from them. And I think that we need to make sure that we do whatever we can to avoid any appearance of impropriety. And that was ultimately the issue, by the way, with Regent Newman, is that it looked bad.
Right.
It looks like a conflict of interest. And we need to make sure that we as regents do whatever we can to avoid the appearance of impropriety. And that goes for little things. You know, it goes...
We're running short on time
here. Oh, man. I want to talk about this all day, Brian.
The FOA department... always takes as much time as possible to respond to a request. Yep. The athletic department had a policy in the past of deleting all emails so that they were not available for FOA. This obviously violates the spirit of the law, but not technically the law. I mean, as a regent, is there something that you can do about this?
Yeah, I think there is, actually. So the regents can pass policies in this. It's part of our transparency pledge that we're going to live up to federal standards by 2020.
Okay.
That means full record retention. That means redaction. That means paying a FOIA office, by the way, that can handle these things. At DHS, these are two of the issues that I worked on. In some of the most secure areas of national security, we still had an obligation that we felt to release whatever we possibly could.
Right.
And I don't think the university is exempt from that. You know, I know you were real involved with the Dave Brandon situation.
Let's not bring that up.
It brings up a really important point. And the important point is that the university's days of hiding behind the Open Meetings Act, hiding behind an absurd way of running the FOIA office, have to end.
And that, this goes back to Michigan State. So, mm-hmm. you know, at Michigan State, you have this culture that is very secretive. They have a FOIA office that's about as bad as Michigan's. And obviously, that is not something that can be tolerated, given what happened at Michigan State.
No.
Right.
It's not, and when you see at any of these university scandals, the one thing that they all have in common is an opaque administration.
Right.
And that's the one thing that we have to make sure that we never go down that path here.
Speaking of, there is kind of a secret executive compensation fund that the University of Michigan has for higher up officers that they have specifically because they feel like it is shielded from FOIA. And what do you feel about that?
I think that you are when you work at a public university, you are a public employee, and I don't think that you can ever hide behind any sort of secret fund. And I will lobby in Lansing to make sure that the Open Meetings Act covers all of the University of Michigan. And I know there's some things that we have to keep secret for competitive purposes, but ultimately anything that is possibly releasable, we have to make sure that we do that.
If you were God on the mountain,
yes,
and you could make one change to the University of Michigan as a region, mm-hmm. what would that be? You don't get any extra money.
Oh, God. What if I could make one...
The one thing that you would do.
The one change that I would make to the university. That is a great question. You know, I think that the biggest thing that I would do, and it's so minor, but I would make all regent votes on the record in public.
Okay.
And the reason why I think this is so important, and I know this is a regent-centric perspective because I'm running for that position, but I think that we need more accountability, honestly.
Okay.
I think that as a traveler around the state, people ask, what do regents do? How do they feel about things? And I think that making sure that we have public accountability is, quite frankly, the most important thing that I could do.
Richard Spencer wanted to speak here.
Yes.
The regents seemed that they felt like they either had to or should permit this. What's your perspective on that?
I think that the regents had some really specific guidelines as to how this could happen.
Right.
But I think that the one thing the university could do, instead of talking about what we're against, I think we have to talk about a lot more about what we're for, the way that University of Florida did. My vision is that, sure.
The University of Florida had a riot.
Well, the University of Florida administration had an idea, and I think that it didn't actually come to fruition, but the idea was that you would have an event simultaneous to that, instead of having people go and riot an incident with Richard Spencer, and have people talk to Holocaust survivors and talk about, see, this is what white supremacy looks like on campus, and this is where we are as a university administration.
At the same time.
I think that it would be around the same time. Yeah, I think that would send a clear message.
Would that work? I mean, a lot of these people are just there to, like, from my perspective, if the university is going to spend the money on security, they should be spending the money on not being forced to spend the money on security.
Well, ultimately,
so, like, when Richard Spencer comes to campus, he's not just coming to campus. He's forcing you to spend millions of dollars to make sure he's safe, because you know that there's, like, a traveling riot following him around.
Sure, sure.
And it feels like a weaponized speech.
Well, it ultimately is. I mean, on the scale, as a lawyer, you know this, there's a continuum from...
I'm not a lawyer.
Well, I'm saying I know as a lawyer, right.
Right.
From free speech to safety and physical safety of people on campus. And I think there's a continuum. I tend to believe that with the restrictions the university put on him coming on campus, he's not likely to come back to campus. But I think that when you have someone like this in the future, someone who is a provocateur, I think you have to continue to create those sorts of standards. So what we don't have here is something that happened like at UVA, where someone dies and they have a major riot. But I think that these situations are difficult, but I think ultimately in this particular one, you have to err on the side of campus safety.
Okay. Jordan Acker, candidate for regent, not a straight ticket ballot. So if you want to vote for him, you got to do it on purpose.
Yeah. It's a really different thing. And obviously there's two Democrats, two Republicans running for two spots
there's
on the board.
Like, the Green
and
Party.
There's the Green Party and a bunch of other minor parties, but so you could vote for two. That was my point.
Right,
of
you can vote
that.
For two.
But there's no straight party voting. You have to vote all the way down the ticket, and of course the nonpartisan section, and of course flip it over to vote for all three statewide proposals. So if nothing else, make sure that you vote next Tuesday, November 6th.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
We're here with Andrea Fisher Newman, who is a sitting regent running for re-election in about 2 days when this podcast actually goes up. And we wanted to, we're talking with all of the Republicans and all the Democrats. And first, I wanted to just get your background and how long you've been sitting on the board and what you feel you've accomplished.
I feel like I've accomplished a lot, but I'm just finishing up my third term, so I'll be running for my fourth term. It's been an incredible honor and a privilege to serve on this board. I've learned a tremendous amount about universities in general, and particularly this one. You know, I think some of the greatest accomplishments come in terms of teaching, academic excellence, the expansions, the new programs, the new buildings, you know, not only staying relevant, but staying ahead of the curve for the university and being a part of that.
And 24 years ago, when you first ran for regent, how did that come about?
So I had been appointed to the Oakland University Board by Governor Engler in 1990. And so I figured out what it was, what it was all about, how a university operates, how the budgets work. But my heart was in Ann Arbor and in Flint and in Dearborn. And so when the opportunity presented itself to run in 1994, I took that opportunity and was privileged enough to be elected.
All right. One of the biggest challenges facing any university these days is affordability. And a couple years ago, Michigan rolled out the Go Blue Guarantee.
We absolutely did.
Which means that anyone in the state who makes whose family makes less than the median amount can go to Michigan tuition free. That encompasses about 16% of the student body. Should Michigan be doing more in that department, and how do they get that number up?
So here's the problem. You're absolutely right what it covers, how many kids it's covering, and where it's heading. The problem is we're taking care of the lower end of the income spectrum, and the high end is fine. We are squeezing out the middle class because we continue to raise tuition to help pay for all these things we want to do, and that hurts the kids that don't qualify for aid but can't afford to be here anyway.
It's a sliding scale, right? Like, if you're making $75K, you're not paying full freight.
No, you're getting aid probably up to about $125,000. So when the family income is $125,000 and there are other parameters under FAFSA that you also have to fit, you are getting some aid, but you're not getting a lot of aid. So it's a sliding scale.
Okay.
So yes, if you're earning under $65,000, which is the median income in the state, your tuition is covered, but your room, books, and board aren't.
Right.
So you still have an expenditure. So some of that also has to be covered through scholarships, grants, and loans.
Well, is there something that the university can do?
Well, we're doing some of it. And I'll tell you, this started for me in 2005, 2006, when the state dropped the appropriation dramatically. And what I insisted on, I guess I called it endowing tuition. We needed to raise the money to start making up the difference to pay for kids to come to school. We called it the President's Challenge in 2006. And we raised $90 million in the first year that went toward financial aid. And what we've done now is we're raising money in this campaign. We raised $1.1 billion for scholarships. Unfortunately, that'll probably only cover about 2,500 kids when you break it down and take out the endowment. And we're continuing to raise money for financial aid. But ultimately, you have to raise enough money so any kid with need, and that includes the middle class, can come. And that's who's getting squeezed under the current current program.
Well, one of the things that makes it hard for a lot of people to live in Ann Arbor is just the sheer cost of living in the city.
Absolutely.
Is there anything that the university can or should be doing to help mitigate that?
I think the university should have different options on housing.
Okay.
I think there should be lower cost housing, and perhaps it comes with different types of food, or perhaps it comes, there's other opportunities to do things. We have a lot of kids here that have food insecurity problems.
How close is the board to, like, taking a step forward on this?
I mean, I'm very close to it because I work on it on a regular basis.
Do you have, like, a particular plan of any sort yet?
Or you know, it starts with raising the money, which we're doing now, and I think we're really focused on scholarship. We are looking at the other aspects of how to be able to afford the campus, whether it's rent, whether it's food. I mean, let's take this over to athletics for a real quick second. You know, some years ago, there were many football players and others on this campus who could be here, and they had scholarships, and they had their room and board, but they weren't eating in between. They couldn't go to a movie.
Right.
And so now they get a stipend so that they can exist here on more than just that. kids that come and aren't athletes don't get that. So maybe that's an opportunity for a path forward for those that need help. There's lots of different types of programs you can do and things you can look at, but it all starts with figuring out, you know, where the most need is and where the money comes from.
Okay. In the Obama administration, the Dear Colleague letter radically reshaped the way that sexual assault is adjudicated on campus. The new Secretary of Education released revised guidelines, and the two kind of main issues there were they wanted to move the standard of evidence from a preponderance to clear and convincing, and they wanted to make sure that the accused was able to cross-examine.
I think that's different, but the preponderance to clear and convincing is what it was before the Obama administration Dear Colleague letter.
Right.
So what they did is they went back to clear and convincing. Quite frankly, this university has not changed what we're doing since the Dear Colleague. What has changed is the Sixth Circuit case, which talks about the cross-examination that you're talking about, I think. And the university said, tried to appeal that and said, you know, that's going to be difficult to do. Could we revisit that? The court recently came back and said no.
Right.
So the university is right now putting together policies to figure out how they're going to do this. But the real issue here, and the university obviously has to be involved in discipline and has to be involved in the safety of the students on this campus. But the real issue here is if you have a real problem, obviously law enforcement needs to be involved.
Right.
The university should not be the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the judge, and the jury. And that's what we've turned into. And it's showing all sorts of weaknesses across the board.
So from your spot as a regent, like, what can you do to adjust what's going on to, like, what you'd prefer exist in the world?
So what I would prefer is if you have a student that believes they've been sexually assaulted, male or female, obviously that deserves an immediate police report, whether it comes from the university or the student, and the university must investigate it through OIE.
Okay.
The university has to be involved in the investigation.
Now, there are some situations where women don't want to report this, and it is almost always
absolutely.
Women. And just, do you think that if you don't want to file a police report, but you still want to go through the university process, should that be allowed?
Absolutely.
Okay. And do you feel like the university is in a good place with it right now, or does it need some changes?
It needs some work.
Okay.
We are in a good place with it, but it's clearly got some problems.
Right.
And people that are talented and experienced in this area are working on trying to put the best we can do together for our students.
Transparency is another big issue, especially in the aftermath of Larry Nassar. Paul Brown's mentioned that, like, that's the first question he gets and the last question he gets when he ever does anything. And it didn't even happen at Michigan. So, personally, I've been a little bit frustrated with the FOIA office at Michigan, which takes as much time as is humanly possible to respond. And then, of course, you know, during the Dave Brandon era, there was an athletic department policy to delete all his emails so that they were not accessible by FOIA. And you've been on the board for a long time. Has there been any motion to, like, looking at this and fixing this, especially after Larry Nassar and the problems with Michigan State's FOIA department?
Yeah, I don't know anything about Michigan State. I think what happened up there is unbelievable. And most of my questions that I get on that is, you know, do you think that could happen here? And I don't. And I say that because we have a very different culture. We don't have micromanagers. There is a reporting mechanism. If there is any indication that something inappropriate or improper might be going on, and our culture here is to shoot it to the top immediately. And from my understanding at Michigan State, that just didn't happen.
That's true. Do you feel like there should be more transparency so that people outside of the university can be seeing these things a little bit better as they develop? Or maybe as a post-mortem?
In terms of FOIA, you're talking about?
Just in terms of FOIA, terms of the fact that, like, so the board has a lot of 8-0 votes, and there's a lot of discussion that you guys have kind of behind the scenes. And I feel like it would be better for the university if you guys had those discussions in public more often.
So most of the so-called behind-the-scenes discussions involve personnel issues or involve you know, things that are not ripe, not baked yet, you know, things that people are thinking about. And I would suggest that, you know, a fair amount of that does take place in public by the time it gets there. What you're seeing in the public meetings is the consent agenda.
Right.
And then you go into finance and property, which is really the approval of buildings and chillers and things like that. And then you go to the conflict of interest section. So what you're not getting is a lot of discussion on issues like climate change. And part of the reason for that is the board's all in favor. So you have people that come to the public meetings and, you know, complain we're not doing enough. But the fact of the matter is the university is actually trying to put things together, trying to get it moving, get on top of it, get out there with it. And so when the board hears it, we're all shaking our heads going, you know, yes, you're absolutely right.
I'm thinking about two specific things.
Okay, go ahead.
One was you guys were talking about the possibility of having Richard Spencer come to campus.
Absolutely.
And that was actually a public conversation.
Very public.
And that was there were protesters in the room, and you guys had expressed your views, and I thought that was good for university. The other thing is that we recently had a contract negotiation with the adjunct professors. And I know for a fact that many regents were very pro a major increase in the adjunct professor salaries.
I think 8 regents were probably pro.
And as they're going through this process, the university itself they're spending tons and tons of man hours on this really tense negotiation process, and nothing is coming from the regent level that is public.
We're not involved with the negotiations.
I know that you're not involved with the negotiations, but this was something that
kind of
felt like you guys could push the university in a direction that they probably should be going, and you guys just kind of didn't.
I don't understand what you mean. I think the regents were very supportive. So having come from the industry I came with, I do understand something about labor negotiations.
Sure.
And you have to let management and labor negotiate. And in any situation, the board would be briefed as to where things stand.
Right.
And so there were briefings going on. There were board members who privately, not necessarily in meetings with other regents. And in fact, I only recall one time when there was a discussion about this, were offering their own individual opinions to management, if you will,
right,
to the president. Ultimately, the decision was made by the university, not by the board, to increase the salary levels, and the contract settled.
Yes.
But there was not a, how do I put this? There was not a discussion among the board on the intricacies of the contract negotiations. There might have been discussions between individual regents,
right,
who had been talking to the union and then talking to the university.
And almost all of this was not public, and I feel
I guess because it was, but okay, I wasn't one of them, so
I don't. This doesn't need to get particularly confrontational.
It's not confrontational at all. I don't know how you make a labor negotiation public.
Okay,
I guess that's the
well. So in the process of the labor negotiation, you know, they're authorizing a strike and stuff, and mm-hmm, it just felt unnecessarily adversarial for something that most of the regents wanted to see get done in the way that the union wanted to get it done.
That's a negotiation.
I understand where you're coming from. It just feels like that's something that,
you know. Oh, nobody likes that. Nobody wants anything adversarial. And hopefully, you know, you had a semi-different team negotiating this time than negotiated the last one.
Yeah.
You have all new management in place since the last one was negotiated.
Do you feel that the adjunct contract is sufficient for the people who do most of the teaching at the university?
I think that we need to give a lot of focus to our lecturers and our faculty. And I think that if you want to do what you say, which is have the best public university in the country, that means you need the best faculty, lecturers, adjuncts, professors. And in order to get the best, you have to pay them.
Okay. Now, the Free Press had a long and in-depth analysis of the endowment and some issues with transparency, and, you know, the guy gives a bunch to the endowment and then we invest in his fund, that kind of thing. Did you feel that exposed some issues that needed to be addressed? Did you feel like you're comfortable with the way Michigan deals with its endowment? Are there any changes that you feel need to be
made? So I think it did expose some issues. I think very early on, where they knew something I didn't know, and this came, I don't know how they got it, it came from someone on the inside, that an audit had not been completed. And that was was extraordinarily troublesome. The president took full responsibility for it and immediately called in PwC to do, you know, a review of everything. But obviously, the audit function was not being properly handled. And it was because of a disagreement between the unit and the internal auditor. But none of that had been brought to light until the Free Press got into it. So for that, you know, I thank them, and I think they did their job, and we obviously needed to do ours.
Okay.
They then decided to, you know, move into the link between donors and investing. And I think that that's a fair subject to discuss. I think in a couple of the cases, they were a little far-fetched. And I think that, you know, it's probably important to, it is important, not probably important, it is important to, if you are, if somebody is a large donor and you are investing in their funds, that should be public. And in our case, it was public because we don't make an investment without doing it in public, and all of our gifts are public. So it was public. We hadn't connected the dots for the audience, and perhaps in the future we should.
Okay. That's about all I have for you.
That's it?
That's it?
We can't talk about athletics?
Well, I mean...
This is MGO Blog.
Yeah, but like...
I mean, come on.
So when you're MGO Blog, you can't talk about athletics because you gotta be respectable and an upstanding citizen who's not just a fanboy.
I'm respectable and upstanding and not just a fanboy or girl.
Did you have something, a topic that you wanted to broach in that department?
No. I do, actually. I think Ward's doing a great job.
Okay.
And I think that... you know, I think we're just kicking it out on all cylinders in athletics right
now. Could you tell him to cut out the piped-in music at Yoast? Yoast doesn't need it, man.
I'll tell him.
I kind of get it at Michigan Stadium these days, but you got the band. Everybody can hear
it. I do like the piped-in music at Michigan Stadium. I know some people don't like it.
I don't like it.
You're a traditionalist.
Well, it's just... So, this is completely irrelevant to our discussion. I feel like it neutralizes the ability of fans to, like, actually interact with the game.
Really?
So, you know... Mr. Brightside is one thing, but like when you're just playing music and you're not letting people get bored, they don't have to invent cool things to do. So like, would the Wave ever have existed if in the 70s they were blasting, I don't know, The Who every time there was a lull in the action? I kind of think not.
Okay, what about that thing they now, the thing that
the
rolls
TIFO?
The team.
Yeah,
I like that. That's kind of cool. That's new.
That's fine. I don't have.
I like the towels. I like it when they do that.
No. Because they, people don't know how to act, and they wave them in your face when you're trying to watch a football game.
Okay. So, well, do you remember?
These are the items that really matter.
Do you remember when Lee Bollinger was president?
I do.
And do you remember the rim around the stadium?
The halo, yes.
Halo.
Halo. How'd you like that?
I did not like that.
Okay. How do you like the boxes?
I like the boxes because it allows Michigan to make money. It doesn't directly impact me. It holds sound in a little bit. You know, what you need is one of those like soccer style stadiums where it's still open, but the people are covered by so they don't get rained on. But that's a ridiculous expense that doesn't need to be made.
Thank you. It's a great university, and it's going to continue to get better no matter what.
So the ballot has changed. You have to vote for the regents on purpose, no straight ticket voting. So after you've listened to all this, go find your favorites and vote for them. Thank you for being on with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
We're here with Andrew Richner, who is a sitting regent. The first thing that we've done in these interviews is kind of talk about your background. And you've been on the board for how many years?
16.
16.
Two terms.
And what kind of motivated you to get involved?
Well, I care deeply about my alma mater. I have 2 degrees from the University of Michigan, both a bachelor's of business administration and a law degree. And long history of U of M degrees in my family, from my grandfather, who graduated from engineering in 1908, to both my parents, to our two kids, who just, my daughter just graduated in May, and she's off in a new career, and our son graduated from undergrad a few years ago. So we're a family that is maize and blue, all the way through, and I care passionately about the University of Michigan. My position, like, I put academic excellence number one. That's what my focus has been since I've been on the board. And everything we can do to promote and continue the legacy of the University of Michigan as one of the premier universities in the world, and really, in my view, the best public university in the world.
So, well, let's talk about how we accomplished that. So there was recently a contract negotiation with the adjunct professors that established a much higher base rate of pay for them. Is that an appropriate amount for them, or are we talking about this is still kind of short of what you would like to see, or is this more appropriate in your view?
Well, I think it was a fair contract. I mean, I know the administration really spent a lot of time on this negotiation and working out the issues on both sides, and I think at the end of the day it was a fair result.
Okay, so in an ideal world, like, what is a full-time Michigan adjunct? What is their socioeconomic class?
Well, you know, that's hard for me to answer because
sure.
I mean, I think people come from different backgrounds and experiences and in different stages in life.
Right.
I mean, I think like any occupation, you have people in a different socioeconomic status.
Okay, should they make about as much as a high school teacher?
Well, I don't know if you can compare the two. I mean, this is, I mean, there are people that teach on a part-time basis, maybe treated differently than
right.
someone who's teaching on a full-time basis,
right.
and, you know, that's their full-time career. I mean, there are, you know, everyone comes at this differently. So I don't think there's a...
Well, it's just from my perspective, it was interesting because I knew how much a full-time adjunct was getting before this contract negotiation, and it was an amount that it would be difficult for anyone who was, like, say they were married to another adjunct, it would be difficult for them to have children without finding a different job. And I think that we've moved towards a place where that is getting towards no longer being the case,
well,
but it's also still like...
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, look, like I said, my focus since I've been on the board is all about academic excellence.
Right.
And it takes resources to pay for the things that
sure.
are important, like salaries and compensation to our staff and those who are teaching in the classroom in particular. Those people I care about deeply. I mean, I want to make sure we're hiring the best, and it takes money to pay for the best.
Okay. The other flip side of that is affordability is obviously a major issue for every university. Michigan recently introduced the Go Blue Guarantee, where anyone making less than the median amount in the state will get free tuition. Is that enough? Does Michigan need to continue doing more in this department?
When it comes to affordability, I mean, what we're trying to do is make sure that everyone who is admitted to the University of Michigan can afford to attend and earn a degree at this institution. And I think we've made tremendous strides, with the Go Blue Guarantee being, you know, prime example of what we've been able to do. You know, under that Go Blue Guarantee, those students who are coming from families of $65,000 or less in family income get a free education for 4 years at the University of Michigan. That's unbelievable when you think about it, because $65,000 is the median family income in the state of Michigan. That means half the families in the state, we're saying,
right.
Hey, you get into the University of Michigan, you're qualified to get in, we're going to make sure you can attend without charge.
Only 16% of the student body actually qualifies for the Go Blue Guarantee, so it kind of feels like there's some recruitment that needs to be done there. How do you kind of get the message out that you can actually come to Ann Arbor?
Actually, I think the number of students who are receiving financial aid in state is 70%. So, I mean, it's a
like
very high percentage.
180, I think, which is a really...
Yeah, it's a sliding scale, and I mean, that I think that's appropriate, too.
But so we mentioned that, like, obviously half the families in the state are under the median, and the only 16% of the student body, I think it might be, I'm sorry, I didn't look this up, but it's either 16% of the student body
yeah.
or 16% of the in-state student body. It kind of feels like there is some...
Well, I understand what you're saying. I mean, yeah. actually, by virtue of the Go Blue Guarantee, we've been able to attract more students from those the lower income ranges.
Right.
And in fact, the numbers are going up.
That's
so that's the right direction, right? Yeah, so we're bringing in students from areas of the state who would really, in the past, haven't considered the University of Michigan as an option. So people, especially those in rural areas, upper peninsula, urban core, I mean, this is what we're, you know, trying to accomplish, and I think we're making progress.
So tuition is only approximately half of the cost to come to college. The rest of it is room and board and books and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And especially in Ann Arbor is expensive and getting more expensive. What, if anything, should the university be doing to help people out in that regard, and especially when it comes to working with
the
city?
Well, the university does look at the other costs. I mean, that's all the all-in cost for attendance. We look at not just you know, tuition, but also room and board and books and the other associated costs. I mean, those are the numbers that are used by the financial aid office.
Right.
And calculating, you know, okay, they look at the income of the family and decide, you know, how much can go towards those costs. I mean, the all-in costs for an education. That's how the athletic scholarships work, for example. I mean,
sure, yeah.
It's the same standard.
Well, so there's, I mean, we're talking about both the under 65 class and then, you know, kind of ranging up to the 100, 125. All those people have to find housing in Ann Arbor, and the university keeps growing their student population. So are there more dorms that should be built, or is there some sort of public-private thing that you guys can do with the city to...
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of housing coming online actually now.
There is,
which is, you know, a good thing when it comes to rents. That does drive down rents.
That's a surprisingly controversial opinion in this town.
Yeah, well, it should anyway drive down rents. But look, we have, since I've been on the board, actually we've seen some residence halls being built.
Yeah,
I mean, North Quad is a prime example. We've got Munger.
Yeah.
In Flint, we built a facility there, and also in Dearborn. So that was a public-private arrangement. And we can do more with the P3s.
Yeah.
Public-private partnerships are the way to go, in my view, because you can do more with less. And, you know, we're looking at these options right now.
Okay. During the Obama administration, the Dear Colleague letter kind of radically reshaped the way that sexual assault is adjudicated on campuses. The new Secretary of Education has issued a revision to that where they moved the standard of evidence back to clear and convincing from preponderance of the evidence. And then another major issue is that, you know, there have been court cases going on, and Michigan has just, I think, lost one where now you have to offer due process to the accused to give them the opportunity to cross-examine their accuser. Are those good changes? Are those bad changes? How do you feel Michigan is doing in this regard, and what changes do you feel need to be made?
You know, this is a difficult issue. And, you know, at the end of the day, you're talking about protecting victims and making sure that they're comfortable coming forward to report. I mean, we really need to encourage and make sure we have a system that does encourage victims to come forward and report sexual misconduct. So if you set up a system that discourages people because they don't want to face, you know, the
right,
the cross examinations and without counsel,
like,
and
a lot of people,
I mean, there are some
forward
serious issues, but also from the accused side, I mean, they're also their due process rights and should be afforded the opportunity to make sure that, you know, they have an opportunity to be heard. So it's a difficult balancing, and of course we're going to comply with the court decisions, and we have to go back and and, you know, we have to relook at our policies and make sure they're in compliance, as do all public universities as a result of this. University of Michigan's policies are not atypical. In fact,
right,
I think most, if not all, of the public universities in the state have a similar policy that we do.
There's been kind of a nationwide attempt to deal with this, and it's going it's middling, I would say. There's a lot of people being suing their universities after being expelled. There's a lot of discontent from often both sides. So it's something that it's been difficult to work through.
You know, I am concerned about the disproportionality, you know, for those, maybe, you know, one side gets counsel, the other can't afford it. Right. I mean, how does that work? You know, that's just one example of, you know, why this is such a nettlesome situation, because you don't want to stack the deck.
Right. And there is people in lower socioeconomic classes and minorities do tend to get the worse outcomes as the accused in these, and that's not a good situation. So, do you have any specific desires in this regard, or?
Well, I mean, with respect to the right to counsel, I mean, that's, you know, that's something we are looking at, and looking for ways that we can, you know, maybe provide counsel. Of course, it's an enormous expense. I mean, I think at the end of the day, actually, a lot of this really should be in the criminal justice system. The University of Michigan is really not equipped in some ways to handle, you know, criminal matters and criminal investigations. I mean, this is not really our function in life. I mean, that should really be the purview of our criminal justice system. So I think what we really need to do is make sure that the victims of these tragedies should really be pursuing that avenue, and we should be encouraging them to report and pursue a criminal action.
In the aftermath of Larry Nassar, I was talking to Paul Brown, one of the Democratic candidates, and he said the first thing he's asked and the last thing he's asked whenever he does anything is about Larry Nassar, despite the fact that didn't happen at Michigan. That kind of has ignited a lot of interest in transparency at the university level. Do you think Michigan's level of transparency is acceptable? Do you feel like things like the FOA office, which tends to obfuscate as much as possible, are at an acceptable level? Do you feel that it's kind of the nature of the board where you get a lot of 8-0 votes, you don't get a lot of public discussion of issues, is at a good place?
Well, transparency can mean a lot of different things here.
All right, well, let's take them one at a time.
Okay, well, with respect to students, I mean, we have FERPA to deal with, the federal laws on privacy, and state laws, too. So, I mean,
So, for one specific example, I did some FOIAs.
And HIPAA as well. That's another, I mean, a privacy law. So we're talking from that standpoint.
Let's talk about a couple of specific examples. When I was FOAing some of Dave Brandon's emails, I was told that he didn't have an email sent in an entire month-long period. And I later discovered that was because the athletic department had a policy of deleting all emails after a certain point in time, specifically so that they could not be FOA'd. Now, that fits with state law. It does not fit with federal law. Do you feel like Michigan should be living up to the federal law, or should they still be at the state level?
The federal law with respect to document retention?
Yes.
Yeah, you're asking me a question that I don't know the specific requirements of federal law with respect to retention. I'm sure we are in compliance, though. I mean,
Michigan is in compliance with the letter of the law. I feel like they're not in compliance with the spirit of what you want from FOA for a public university.
Yeah, we should have consistency in our policies. I mean, I do think that when it comes to document retention, FOIA, how we handle the privacy laws, yes, there should be some uniformity and consistency within different departments and units in the university. So maybe, you know, there could be, I'm not specifically aware of what the athletic department is doing with their emails, but it should be really...
I don't need you to commit to a course of action. I just want to get your overall opinion of how Michigan's doing in this department.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's something we should look at in terms of, you know, email retention and how those, you know, what our policies are on that issue. I think there's a lot of information flow at the university. In some ways, more information is not necessarily more transparency.
Okay.
That there should be, you know, I think we get, as the board, we get a lot of information. And sometimes I think, like, it's overload, and it would be better to have more organized information and easier to, you know, absorb information, and I think that's something we can improve upon.
Okay.
And for the public, I mean, sending out information in, you know, in a form that's understandable and can really show what's important in terms of information for the university.
So And one of the other things I was kind of getting at is that Richard Spencer wants to come and have an event on campus. And there was a contentious Regents meeting where you guys were talking in public about your opinions in this regard with Schlissel there. There were protesters. It was tense. But I thought it was kind of unique in the fact that we were actually hearing the Regents' opinions on a contentious matter. Usually it's kind of just like, we're going to go with the flow. This is an 8-0 vote. There's not a whole lot of talking at these meetings that... I kind of feel like there are more issues than just Richard Spencer that kind of deserve that wider hearing. I mean, does that kind of...
Yeah, we did have an extensive debate about Richard Spencer in public. It was an important issue to the community.
Right.
And we all had an opportunity to express our views. And I think we do. When those issues come up, we do have a public hearing and discussion.
Last,
I mean, for example, tuition that. Every year. That's okay. A full-fledged discussion about each of our different viewpoints on what the university ought to be doing. And, you know, you look at what we're required to vote on when it comes to property,
transactions. There's a lot of consent agenda stuff.
You know, those are really not controversial issues, right? So we as a board are... Our responsibility is not just to, you know, every meeting to have a full-fledged debate on some, you know, public policy issue that may or may not be affecting the university. What we have to concentrate on is, you know, our responsibility as a board, as fiduciaries for the taxpayers, as, you know, providing oversight of the university's operation, making sure that, you know, the administration's held accountable for their decisions. But we can't manage the university on a day-to-day basis. You know, the University of Michigan actually is the largest employer in the state of Michigan. It is a very large and complex organization. And, you know, from the board's perspective, we are volunteers. We don't get paid for this job. It's an important job. But most of us have jobs outside of, you know, being a member of the Board of Regents. So we can't, you know, micromanage. And we have to concentrate when we get to those board meetings and discussions on the really important issues affecting the university.
So the Free Press recently had kind of an extensive series of articles about Michigan's endowment, detailing, irregularities, but some issues that looked like it could be, you know, self-dealing. Guy has a large donation to the university they invest in his fund, that kind of thing. Did that series expose any changes that you think need to be made with Michigan's handling of the endowment?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there really were no accusations of wrongdoing.
I want to be clear about that. That's true. I was trying to phrase it correctly. You know, it's more about like, there's kind of the appearance of possible improprieties.
Yeah. So when you're getting into appearances, you know, can we? We can always do better, right? In everything we do, and we strive to really employ the best policies and practices. And I think that, in fact, we have made a few changes.
Okay.
We're looking at more changes. Some came at the recommendation of the audit firm that audited our policies and practices, and others, the board members suggested themselves, including, you know, I thought it was important that we have written conflict of interest disclosures for all board members, for the financial advisory committee members, and we did implement that policy. Like I said, we've also implemented policies and recommendations suggested by the auditing firm. So one of the recommendations of the auditing firm was to provide that the board would vote on an annual basis on a model portfolio for the investment fund. So that, I thought that was an important change because we want to make sure that... You know, when it comes to the portfolio, diversity is important in your portfolio so that you're not exposed to undue risk. And we don't want our investment officers putting all the money into, you know,
Enron.
Vegas or something. Right. I don't know. So we set up, through this model portfolio, parameters that the investment officer has to stay within. It's a very important protection, and you know, it's best practices in the industry, and so we implemented that. So that's just good. Another example of
so the Free Press how this, yeah, article caused some changes that you feel are good changes.
Yes, I think we didn't throw up walls and say, hey, sure, we're doing everything right. No, we want to look at all our policies. Well,
I think that's a good thing, and I think it's different from some other university boards.
Well, that's why, you know, I think, knock on wood, but we haven't seen the issues that others have seen. Yeah. So I think it's all good.
All right, last question. If you were God on the mountain and you could change one thing about the University of Michigan, you don't get any extra money, what would that be?
Now, can I talk about sports here? I guess if I could do one more thing, I would make it more accessible. I mean, I just think the University of Michigan is such a special place. I want every student in the coming out of high school and university to,
you want to I want expand every, the university to be all of Michigan.
I want everyone to be able to experience what the University of Michigan has to offer. I look at how it's affected my own kids and just the opportunities that it has afforded to them and of course to me. It was a tremendous experience for me, I know for my kids, to attend the University of Michigan. If there were a way to offer that same opportunity to every student coming out of high school, and really what we need to do, I mean, look, we need to make sure that those kids who are in high school are getting the education and the experience that they need to be equipped to handle a really challenging economic environment.
That sounds like it costs money, but I'm going to allow
that. No, it's not. Look, I think K through 12, we need to do a better job at that level.
Sure.
And because we can do things to bridge from high school to college and get those kids prepared who might not have had the same opportunities K through 12 that others have had. But that's what I would change. I would really focus on improving the educational environment for those kids before they come to us so that they can make it when they get here. And like I said, I want everyone in the state of Michigan to have that opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Anything else you want to get off your chest?
I'm just looking forward to the rest of the football season. And, you know, we're looking at a possible, I'm not going to say national championship, but I'm really excited.
Tua's out there.
What's that?
Tua's out there. Alabama's quarterback.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
no,
he's lurking. He's pretty good.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
I don't know if you've watched any Alabama. I wouldn't recommend it.
I caught a glimpse of him last night, against LSU. But they're tough. I just want to get into the mix there.
The number of things that people could say would be very reduced. I would enjoy that.
Well, let me talk a little bit more about affordability because I really think, no one really likes to vote for tuition increases, of course, right?
Right.
When the state revenues are declining, when I left the legislature in 2002, the state appropriation for Ann Arbor was $365 million. This year, it's about $355 million. So in 16 years, we haven't even gotten back to where we were. And that doesn't include inflation and the higher costs the University of Michigan is facing. First thing we do is look at cutting costs. That's the easy thing. You know, we can cut costs, and we have cut costs. There are ways to create more efficiencies in the way we operate. I'd like to shift more resources from staff and administrative functions to the classroom, and we have done that. We've actually put more faculty out there, and as a consequence, the class size ratios have gone down, and our rankings go up as a consequence. But it does take resources.
It does.
You're not going to cut your way to excellence,
right?
And we need to look for alternative revenue sources. I think we could do better there. I mean, we've got this online education, online learning, and a lot of opportunities in that area. And I think we need to be a leader in looking at online education and revenue ways to increase our revenues. So, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, like I said, with the state appropriations, it's always a challenge to deal with those budget issues, and we need to do better. I don't like voting for tuition. I mean, I actually have, on occasion, I voted against it because I felt that we could have done better.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's nevertheless, I think we've done a good job at retaining that affordability by providing additional student aid.
All right, Andrew Richner, this time there's no straight ticket voting, so you have to go vote for the Regents on purpose. I hope you will do so.
All right, thanks, Brian. Really appreciate
the
time.
Thanks for coming in.